This is VOA News. Reporting via remote, I'm Jeff Custer. Foreign ministers from the Group of Seven Economic Powers Wednesday issued a statement calling for China to preserve peace and stability in Taiwan Strait after China issued a series of threats and staged military exercises in protest of U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's visit to Taiwan earlier in the day. China claims Taiwan is its territory and opposes any engagement by Taiwanese officials with foreign governments. Despite those warnings, Pelosi met with Taiwanese leaders Wednesday and spoke to Parliament, pledging U.S. support to the self-governing island. After Pelosi's arrival, China began military drills, including live fire exercises in the waters and skies around Taiwan after her arrival. Experts warn using live fire in the country's territorial airspace or waters could be seen as an act of war. In their statement, the G7 minister said there is no justification to use a visit as pretext for aggressive military activity in the Taiwan Strait. They said it is routine for legislators from their countries to travel internationally, and China's response risks increasing tensions and destabilizing the region. In an interview Wednesday, British Foreign Minister Elizabeth Truss, one of the signees of the statement and a leading candidate to replace Boris Johnson as Britain's prime minister, said China's response was inappropriate.
Well, I do not support China's inflammatory language on this issue. It's perfectly reasonable what is taking place, and I urge China to de-escalate.
The G7 statement was signed by foreign ministers from Britain, Canada, France, Germany, Italy, Japan, and the U.S. Pelosi left Taiwan less than 24 hours after arriving, headed for South Korea, the next stop on her Asian tour. This is VOA News. Ukraine's ambassador to Lebanon Wednesday called on Lebanese officials to prevent a Syrian ship docked at a Lebanese port from leaving, insisting the ship is carrying Ukrainian grain stolen by Russia. The Syrian Lucia has been anchored at the port of Tripoli since last Thursday, carrying 10,000 tons of wheat, flour, and barley. Last Friday, a senior Lebanese customs official said Ukraine's claims were untrue and that the vessel's papers appeared to be in order following an inspection. But at a news conference in Beirut Wednesday, Ukrainian ambassador to Lebanon, Ihor Ostosh, told reporters he had additional evidence to substantiate his claims, which he has submitted to Lebanese prosecutors. The claim comes just days before the tiny cash-strapped country is due to receive 26,000 tons of corn in Ukraine's first grain shipment since Russia's invasion began over 5 months ago. Italy's parliament Wednesday gave its final approval to a bill ratifying the accession of Finland and Sweden to the NATO alliance. The Italian Senate voted 202-13 in favor of the bill a day after the lower house approved it by a large majority. The accession needs to be ratified by the parliaments of all 30 North Atlantic Treaty Organization members before Finland and Sweden can be protected by the NATO defense clause that states an attack on one member is an attack against all. NATO approved membership of the two nations earlier this year. Both had historically taken a neutral stance on joining the alliance until Russia's invasion of Ukraine in February changed their minds. The U.S. Senate is debating the accession of the two Nordic nations Wednesday, and a vote is expected later in the day. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell told his colleagues he believes the vote should be unanimous.
There's just no question that admitting these robust democratic countries with modern economies and capable interoperable militaries will only strengthen the most successful military alliance in human history.
The Icelandic Meteorological Office declared a code red alert after a volcano erupted Wednesday near the capital, Reykjavik, at a site that erupted last year. The Meteorological Office said the eruption took place in an unpopulated area 30 kilometers from the capital city and no lives were in danger. The eruption is near the site of Mount Fagradalsfjall volcano, which had been active from March to September of 2021. The office said if Wednesday's volcanic activity is confirmed to be similar to the fissures seen last year, the code red aviation alert could be lowered to orange, signaling less danger. A witness reported lava was coming from a crack in the ground near the site. Iceland is known for earthquakes that sometimes cause volcanic eruptions because the Earth's largest tectonic plates lie under the country. Repeating the hour's top news story, foreign ministers from the G7 economic powers Wednesday issued a statement calling for China to preserve the peace and stability in the Taiwan Strait, calling Taiwan to comply. Visit.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
They're in North Africa. They're in the Sahel. They're throughout the Middle East. They're in Yemen. I get that we're focused on Afghanistan right now, but we're not taking our eye off the rest of the world either.
That was John Kirby, head of the Strategic Communications for the U.S. National Security Council, on the killings of the head of the Al-Qaeda movement. Details coming up. Also, Nigerian police have increased security around the capital, Abuja. We'll have these stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. Kenyans are being bombarded with campaign ads and political speeches in the run-up to the presidential election on Tuesday. President Uhuru Kenyatta, the rich son of the country's founding leader, has thrown his support to longtime rival Raila Odinga, who is leading in the latest opinion polls by 6 percentage points over his closest competitor, Deputy President William Ruto. Kenyatta has deflected allegations of graft by calling for transparency, but has done little in 10 years in office to usher in change. VOA Africa 54 managing editor Vincent McCore says corruption is a big issue for Kenyans, adding that some young people say they are not even planning to vote.
One of the things they mention is that they feel like the politicians are self-serving. They're not only pouring tons of money out there, but once they get in, they try to recoup those monies. They try to help themselves to get even wealthier. So there is a lot of disenchantment, especially among the youth.
You're saying people are so disgusted that they're not even going to go and vote, a lot of people?
I mean, I won't say a lot of people, but I'm saying there is a section of the Kenyan population that says it doesn't see the value of even participating in the election because their conditions, their state of livelihoods never seems to change even after an election. But of course, the politicians have been all over the country doing as much as they can to call people to come out and vote in huge numbers.
Talking about these two main candidates, how do their campaign platform speeches differ?
You know, when I listen to both sides, and actually, you know, we've been talking a lot about Raila Odinga and William Ruto, but we have to face it, there are two other presidential candidates. There's Professor George Wajakoya, and there is Maura, a presidential candidate, Maure. When you listen to all the candidates, really, they're all talking about the same things, except for Professor George Wajakoya. Now, if I take the other three, Raila Odinga, Ruto and Maure, they're all talking about improving access to healthcare, improving education, improving the economy, ensuring that there's security in the country, and of course, the state of food. Now, it's a question of how they package this. It's about how they convince, they're trying to convince people how they are better placed to actually fulfill those aspirations of the people. The only difference, which looks a little bit odd to most Kenyans, the candidate called George Wajakoya is a kind of ideas sounding more eccentric to most to some Kenyans. For example, he has vowed to legalize the sale of marijuana. He thinks Kenya can make tons of money.
You're in Nairobi, of course, but when you travel or when your colleagues travel outside Nairobi, the capital, what are they seeing and what are people saying there? Do they have a different candidate that they like better in other places around the country, you know, based on what they're hearing from them and just what they know about the candidates?
Actually, you know, the Kenyan candidates really canvass the country and generally sell themselves to the people. They travel to the people. So the most I can say that you can say is of a difference. The greater difference is how the people in the urban areas kind of react to some of the things they hear, as opposed to people in the countryside. The people in the countryside tend to kind of to be more inclined to support a candidate who is either from their area, or sometimes whoever is able to really tell them how he will solve some of their problems. Now, Kenyans in the countryside have different kind of issues. Those who live in the arid areas, they want to hear how you will bring water to their area, how you'll help them.
Is there anything I haven't asked you that you think is important to point out about this upcoming election and what you're seeing there?
One of the things that people are concerned about is the aftermath, the post-election. There are concerns that there could be some level of violence, not necessarily extreme, but especially because of some of the utterances from some of the candidates, but also social media, kind of information going out there creates a discomfort among many Kenyans that there could be a situation, but they don't know exactly where and how.
That was VOA Africa 54 Managing Editor Vincent Macori, who was speaking with VOA's Carol Van Dam from Nairobi today. Human Rights Watch and good governance groups are urging Kenyan authorities to do more to prevent potential violence during Tuesday's elections. They say that the government has not credibly investigated alleged police involvement in recent extrajudicial killings, and authorities have not ensured justice for police abuses in the 2017 polls in which 104 people were killed. Human Rights Watch says over the past 15 years, the government has failed to guarantee the independence of the Inspector General of Police and the oversight authority that investigates complaints. Observers say probes have also been hampered by political interference and a lack of cooperation among the police services. They say the government has stopped vetting police to remove those involved in abuses, while some have even been rehired. Activists are urging the police to follow the law, which says lethal force should only be used when non-violent measures to protect lives are not sufficient. Human Rights Watch says its executive director, Kenneth Roth, has met with presidential candidate William Ruto and with Martha Karua, the running mate of presidential candidate Raila Odinga. Both promise to use the courts to peacefully resolve any disputes that emerge from the elections and to discourage their supporters from violence. South African police have launched what they're calling a full-scale crackdown on illegal mining. It's taking place particularly in Gauteng province, where hundreds of abandoned mines date back to the 1800s gold rush near Johannesburg. The police action comes after the horrific gang rape of 9 women who were filming a music video near an old mine in the town of Krugersdorp last week. The police and local residents have blamed the attack on illegal miners called Zamazamas. Here's Darren Taylor.
Communities living near old mines have for years complained of being terrorized by Zamazama gangs. They say gang members, often armed with AK-47 rifles and machetes, are usually dressed in balaclavas and blankets. This is traditional attire of the Basutu people of Lesotho, the tiny mountain kingdom contained within the borders of South Africa. Police acknowledge they haven't done enough to combat illegal mining, and the Zamazamas have perpetrated crimes with relative impunity. This changed yesterday when hundreds of officers descended on abandoned mines around Gauteng. They arrested almost 50 alleged illegal miners, seizing a variety of weapons and gold. At one scene, Gauteng Police Commissioner Elias Mawela told reporters two Zamazama shooters opened fire on officers.
The one with the pink was carrying a pistol and the one with the black jacket was carrying the rifle. Then we mobilized the chopper. When our ground forces, they were searching for them, they picked them up where they were hiding. But unfortunately,
he pointed to an area almost completely enclosed by huge mine dumps.
In there, we have found a fresh processing center of this illegal mining. So when the operators are operating that side, they do have the security guys, these people with the heavy caliber firearm, protecting the industry so that they can also spot the police when they are coming and so forth. So clearly these ones, they were protecting those ones who were operating that site.
General Mawela said most of those arrested are undocumented migrants from Lesotho and Mozambique.
You may find that some of them, you know, through the DNA, through their fingerprints, they may be linked to other crimes which were committed elsewhere in the country or in Gauteng.
He said some of the alleged illegal minors in custody are boys aged between 12 and 16. Their arrests doesn't surprise Hawke's Police Unit investigator, Dave Davis. He says the gangs force boys trafficked to South Africa from neighboring countries to work in narrow tunnels in which they're sometimes buried alive. Davis explained the Zama Zama's modus operandi during a raid at a small lake west of Johannesburg.
They steal this gold-bearing material from different mines. They bring it here because of the water at the back. They use this to wash down the gold-bearing material on James tables, and then they eventually make amalgam with mercury, burn that and get gold nuggets, which makes its way into the illicit market.
Mawela promised ongoing intensive actions against illegal mining.
Focus, it will be to try to retrieve the firearms which are currently in the wrong hands. Because when you see the level of violent crime, it is alarming and it is disturbing. And it is all over Gauteng, no doubt about it. But we'll deal with them systematically, and intelligence will guide us that this day we go elsewhere, tomorrow we go elsewhere. Even tomorrow we'll have another big one.
The police crackdown on the Zama Zamas has received mixed reaction from the public. Some have commended it. Others have questioned why it's taken a vicious gang rape to spur law enforcement into acting against gangs that have been inspiring fear for almost two decades. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Malawi's Nurses Union is urging President Lazarus Chakwera to allow about 2,000 nurses to work in the United States and Saudi Arabia after the government ordered the plan be stopped. The National Organization of Nurses and Midwives of Malawi announced the plan a month ago, saying the nurses were forced to take jobs abroad due to high unemployment in Malawi. The healthcare brain drain raised concerns, and the Ministry of Labor on Tuesday ordered the plan cancelled, saying the union has no legal mandate on labor migration. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre, Malawi.
Malawi's Minister of Labor, Vera Kantukule, told VOA Tuesday that the decision to suspend the plans were made after considering that the National Organization of Nurses and Midwives of Malawi is just a union of medical workers.
What we told them was if you want to be doing this thing, then probably you may have to register a separate entity that is going to be doing recruitment. But you, the way you are, your mandate does not allow you to engage yourselves in labor migration.
Kantukule said there's also need for a memorandum of understanding between the countries where the nurses are going to work and the Malawi government before the nurses' organization can proceed with its plans. The memorandum of understanding would deal with how Malawian nurses would be taken care of in these countries. The labor minister says Malawi is among the countries where the World Health Organization has put restrictions on medical workers' migration.
The last time we had an inquiry from Scotland, I think one of the hospitals in Scotland that had wanted also to do this. The Scottish government got that response from the WHO, said Malawi is on the list of those countries from which you cannot take their health personnel.
Shouts Smith as the president of the nurses organization in Malawi. He says he is surprised with the ministry's position on the matter.
The minister cannot cancel this thing. The minister has no mandate altogether to tell us that we don't have the mandate. That's being rude, in fact. And it is government that identified us as norm to facilitate this. And government has also said that it is not the only entity to recruit. And that is why the head of state, Dr. Chakwera, says the job creation campaign. And that's exactly what we are doing.
Smeza says the decision to seek jobs for nurses abroad came because 3,000 trained nurses in Malawi are unemployed. Smeza said the earlier arrangement was that the first group of 1,000 nurses were expected to leave for Saudi Arabia this month. The plan is to send 1,000 each year for a five-year project. But he said there was a delay because they were waiting for guidelines from various ministries, including the Minister of Health, Minister of Foreign Affairs, and Minister of Labour, on how to move forward.
The team that we're sending out are our members. They are not employed by government ministry. So they don't belong to any ministry. They don't. So we went seeking guidance from the Ministry of Labour on the safety and security of the membership that is going to U.S. Saudi Arabia.
The Malawi government said recently that it cannot recruit more nurses now because of financial constraints. In a statement Tuesday, a group of Malawi's nurses and midwives urged President Chakwera to intervene on the matter and stop the Minister of Labour from halting the plan to send some of them abroad to work. There was no immediate response from President Chakwera on the matter. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre, Malawi.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Please note we have moved our programs from voanews.com to voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. Find us on voaafrica.com. Nigerian police have increased security around the capital Abuja after last week's ambush of presidential guards in a suburb and a deadly attack on a military checkpoint. Nigerian media reported two soldiers were killed in the July 28th attack and others were injured. The attack came just weeks after a brazen jailbreak in Abuja that freed hundreds, including high-profile terrorism convicts. Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja, Nigeria.
The reinforcement was announced Tuesday by National Police spokesperson Muyiwa Adejobi following a National Security Management Team meeting held in Abuja. Adejobi said the police have ordered a massive deployment of operatives and operational assets around the capital, but did not disclose how many more officers will be deployed. Adejobi did not respond to VOA's request for more details on Wednesday, but Abuja police spokesperson Josephine Ade told VOA the decision to withhold operational details was in the interest of security.
Crime has taken a new trend and we too were re-strategizing, that's all. We are doing more deployments. That is the strategy we are taking. We will see more visibility.
The massive deployment comes amid rising security threats in the Nigerian capital, even though authorities have told citizens not to worry. Local media reports two soldiers were killed during an attack on a military checkpoint in Niger State near Abuja last Friday. It was the second recent attack in Abuja blamed on the militant group Islamic State West Africa Province. An attack last month on an Abuja prison freed about 440 inmates, including many alleged terrorists. The American nonprofit Site Intelligence Group says Friday's attack was an indication that the Islamic State group has drawn too close to the Nigerian capital. Police spokesperson Ade says residents must place their trust in the security forces.
Always been assuring the residents of S City that everything is under control, but they choose to believe fake news and whatever they see on social media. There's no cause for alarm. People should go about their lawful business.
Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari has condemned latest attacks in the country and said he had, quote, given security forces full freedom to bring an end to this madness, end quote. But security analyst Senator Irebu says authorities have failed to deliver on its promise to make the country safe.
Though we have a very faulty security architecture, but the security apparatus can effectively deal with the problem arising from these terrorists. The challenge we're having is that the political will is not there, especially from the presidency. They keep on pushing, assessing the blame to others, not taking responsibility.
Nigeria faces growing insecurity, especially in its northern states. Last week, an Abuja-based security and risk management firm, Beacon Security Consulting, said violent attacks in Nigeria increased by 47% in the first half of the year compared to 2021. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
The U.S.-directed killing of al-Qaeda's leader in Afghanistan was a blow to the terror group's leadership, but will it affect its offshoots in the Middle East, Africa, and Asia? The White House says it's not taking its eyes off any terror threats that arise, and terrorism researchers say the U.S. needs to be vigilant and patient. VOA's Anita Powell reports from the White House.
The White House says it has high confidence that its targeted strike killed al-Qaeda chief Ayman al-Zawahiri.
We have eliminated the emir of al-Qaeda.
But the White House also says cutting off the head of the beast may not neutralize the threat. John Kirby is head of strategic communications for the National Security Council.
They're in North Africa. They're in the Sahel. They're throughout the Middle East. They're in Yemen. I get that we're focused on Afghanistan right now, but we're not taking our eye off the rest of the world either.
Since Osama bin Laden formed the group in 1988, al-Qaeda has sprouted numerous offshoots, united over the decades by intolerance, hatred of the U.S. and Israel, and a strict interpretation of Islam. Michael Kugelman is deputy director of the Asia program at the Wilson Center. He spoke to VOA via Zoom.
Al-Qaeda may not be actively, operationally planning an attack on U.S. soil, but ideologically, it remains ideologically opposed to the U.S. That very fact is something that we shouldn't overlook.
Especially in Africa, where affiliates have flourished. Martin Ewe is a senior researcher at the Institute for Security Studies based in Pretoria, South Africa. He spoke to VOA via Zoom.
My advice to Biden and to the American government is that, we can kill the leadership, but I think it's a very tiny aspect of the fight against terrorism. The focus should actually be on addressing, the factors, the political and economic factors that actually shield terrorism, or which actually give oxygen, to terrorism around the world.
But al-Zawahiri's death will affect these groups. Although he was not a charismatic leader like bin Laden, he was a disciplined one. Colin Clark is director of policy and research at the Sufan Group. He spoke to VOA via Zoom.
Zawahiri was effective in kind of keeping this broader network of affiliates, franchise groups, and branches together, from the Sahel to the Horn of Africa and further afield. That's probably what he should get the most credit for, is maintaining that alliance and doing it through the turbulent period of the Arab Spring and the rise of the Islamic State.
So what now? On that, the president was clear.
My administration will continue to vigilantly monitor and address threats from al-Qaeda, no matter where they emanate from.
Analysts also urged patience.
These groups are patient and they're highly capable. And so to dismiss them as kind of a nuisance or a has-been, and I know everybody wants to focus on great power competition with Russia and China and kind of leave behind the global war on terrorism, I would say, let's not get ahead of ourselves.
Al-Qaeda attacked the World Trade Center the first time in 1993, killing 6 people. At the time, they were a relatively obscure group, until September 11th, 2001. Anita Powell, VOA News, The White House.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyes Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, and our engineer, Cedric Franklin, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.